Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
And each episode, our special guest or guests bring with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, our guests are Rachel Kempf and Nick Todi. They are the founders of the indie press Die Die Books and the directors of the micro-budget found footage film It Doesn't Get Any Better Than This. Welcome to the show!
Thank you! Thank you.
We're really excited to chat with you. I found out your film through Mary Beth, and we both really dug it. So if you could let our listeners know a little bit about the film in case they have not heard of it yet.
Sure. Yeah. So it's a found footage movie. All three of the main characters, Nick, myself, and my best friend, we're all playing ourselves. We've all known each other since college. So we have like 20 years of actual footage of us being idiots together that's just sort of woven into the movie as well. And we put way more of that footage in than was probably wise. The plot is that Nick and I, as indie filmmakers, buy this abandoned duplex to shoot our next horror film in. And as soon as we buy the place, we start seeing like random strangers will just like stop and stare at the building, sometimes for hours. And things just get like weirder and creepier from there. And it creepier past the point where like a normal person, normal people would be like, it's scary and like sell the place or leave or call the cops. But we're just so delighted at how terrifying the place is that the scarier it gets, the more we love it. And the whole movie is just Nick, myself, and my best friend, like first realizing, okay, our lives have become a horror movie, and then just making a series of like increasingly terrible decisions to see how scary that movie can get.
It's so funny because like the thing that I was immediately drawn to is how much of a sense of humor, particularly you, Rachel, have in it, where like you're laughing it off the entire time. And it's like, I'm watching this going, this is totally me. If I bought a duplex and I moved in there to film a creepy movie and all of a sudden there is a candle in the attic and there's weird shit happening, I would be trying to push that envelope so far. And Mary Beth knows this is true. And so it made me laugh so much because I was like, I feel seen.
Yay. Yeah, one of my favorite comments that we've gotten from anybody about the movie was our friend Oscar basically just said, Rachel was pissing herself laughing the entire movie. And I was like, great, yeah, perfect, she is. That was basically, we sort of went into it saying, okay, well, I mean, we're pretty smart in real life, but we thought that's not interesting for a found footage movie. So what's the most idiotic version of ourselves at any given moment? And what would that person do? And so that was pretty much where the plot of the movie came from.
Hell yeah. So is that duplex that you buy in the movie, did you buy that in
real life? We're not that smart. We did actually buy this duplex just to shoot horror movies in. So yeah,
it was just to shoot horror movies in?
Yeah, we were shooting, we bought it to shoot a movie called Homebody, which we're actually shooting next summer, or this coming summer. And we're going to need to fix the place up a lot in order to be able to shoot this next one. And we just said, basically on buying it, we were like, let's make a found footage movie immediately. And we basically started shooting it that week.
Yeah. Well, and there was so, it was partly because too, we had to fix it up and it was like, this is a bummer for fixing this place up to shoot a horror movie in is just a wasted opportunity because it is so much scarier. It was just filled with trash when we first got it and just this terrifying nightmare of a place, this weird stuff, doors everywhere, and like chains on the wall. We're just like, what the ever, not chains. Some kind of like weird springs stuff on the wall. Oh, like, but we're just like, what is this place? So we were like, well, wait, why waste this production value? We've just shoot a movie about us exploring this place. And yeah.
But yeah. And then we basically like made up the movie as we went along. Like we came up with a basic structure and we sort of had some rules, but those rules were based in, so I have a background in actual documentary filmmaking, and we tried to make this movie follow those same sorts of rules, because, you know, when you're making a documentary, if you've learned something as you're going along that changes your story, you adapt what you're doing accordingly. And we did that, the same approach, where we would go in with an idea for shooting, and then maybe something would happen that we didn't quite expect, or a performance would kind of be nuanced in a way that was different from what we had originally planned, but in a way that we liked. We would then steer the story of the movie in that direction so that it was always just going for whatever seemed most alive, whatever seemed most interesting to us. And hopefully also, I don't think being scary was ever really our top priority. We knew it was a horror movie, but we... You know, but also there was always just kind of like, what's most interesting, what's most fun for us. And then if it was also scary, we kind of didn't know until we were editing it whether it was actually scary or not. And even then it kind of, we've had some audiences who are like, this scared the shit out of me. You know, we had one viewer, we screened it in Chicago a couple months ago. And there was one viewer who was like, this is the scariest movie I've seen this year. Also, one of the scenes in it is exactly like a recurring nightmare that I've had. And I don't know which scene it is. I have an idea of which one it is, but I didn't get to ask her specifically which one it was. But yeah, so for some audiences, it really, really, really resonates on a scare level. And that's great. Also, even though the whole time we were making it, we were just laughing and we're just like, well, if this is, we know it's going to be a fun movie. If it's also a scary movie, then that's going to be also very great on top of it, since it is horror.
I don't know, Nick, if I've communicated this to you sufficiently ever, but the whole time I was really rooting for it to be scary. I know you were always like, I don't know that this probably isn't going to be scary. Like we're being so ridiculous, but the other thing too, we were editing, simultaneously while we were shooting. So we found out like basically there were like four or five scenes in the middle that like I strung together at one point, and I was just like, I just want to see how these like play together. Just to see, because we found out during editing, like, oh, we got to go back and shoot some scenes to make this like work. So we come up with more scenes. But when I first strung together, like there was a sequence of scenes like in the middle, and I like ran into like the other room and was like, Nick, our movie is scary. I was watching it. I put four scenes together and I felt so scared by the end of it. Like maybe it's going to be scary. I was so, so delighted when that happened.
What a good feeling. You're like, yeah. Oh yeah, hell yeah. We got the feeling. We got the vibes. But did anything actually spooky happen to you in that set? In the house? I have to know. To know.
Yes.
Yes.
So many things. So many things.
Tell me everything right now.
Okay. Well, I mean, and also some of it we just started incorporating into the movie, because it's like if stuff happens, you just use it. And so, okay. I don't want to... All right. I'm going, how much do we want to give away here? But... I don't think this really gives anything away. Okay, but at the end of the movie, there's a scene where there's a bunch of junk in the duplex. You both have seen it, so you will know the scene I'm talking about, like right at the very, towards the very end of the movie. If you pay close attention in that scene, you will notice, if you go back and watch, you'll see there's a crucifix among the various things that are there. That crucifix was actually left in the duplex at some point while we were filming it by somebody. We have no idea who. We just went in one day and there was a crucifix, a stack of children's books, an iPhone charger, and a USB thumb drive that when I took it home and checked what was on it, it had a recording of like it was like a communications class assignment to record a fake episode of a podcast about a nonprofit organization. So just like some completely random thing from some college students. But like, why was there a crucifix, a stack of children's books, this thumb drive, and a phone charger? Like, it makes no sense, but it was just there one day.
And a handful of those, like the crucifix for sure, but even the children's books a little bit and the USB thing all kind of have echoes in the movie. Nick, we come home and Nick is like, did you do this? Did you put those? And it looked like placed. And he was like, did you put that there? Tell me you didn't put that there. Like, I need to know. Like, he really.
Yeah, I made her. I was like, swear on your mom's life. Like, swear to God. Dude. Like, I was like, if you're fucking with me, I appreciate it. But I actually do need to know. I need to know that. And she convinced me that she wasn't. So.
It wasn't me. It wasn't me. I never thought it was you, for the record. But you were so certain it was me. But yeah, that happened. And then this probably wasn't a ghost that we caught on camera. But we cannot say for sure that it wasn't. Okay, we're like filming. I'm going back through like footage that I had like edited. And I can't remember. Oh, I was like listening. I was doing like sound editing. And I'm like listening. And there's a part in the movie where like me and Christian, my friend, are calling for Nick in the duplex, and we're going, Nick, 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 and you hear this voice while we're going, like, you hear my voice, Christian's voice, and then you hear Nick, which is not my voice, it is not Christian's voice, and it is not Nick's voice, it doesn't sound like any of us, so the options are either, like, there's a ghost, and that was the voice of the ghost, or some rando was walking past the duplex, heard us yelling Nick, Nick, and decided to get in on the action. Or there's a third option. It's less fun, but I'll explain the
third option, which is that I went back and because I wanted to solve this mystery, because and also it's like, I don't know, maybe this can be worked into the movie. And I went back and I'm 90%, I'm the most skeptical of all the people who made the movie, just in general. You know, I'm the one who's the skeptic. And so I wanted to review every frame of footage to see if I could find an explanation of it. And I did find an explanation for it that, as a skeptic, I'm like, this has to be the explanation. So in the exact moment when Rachel and Christian were shouting my name and you hear this other voice shout my name also, I was hiding from Rachel and Christian in a place where I was actually able to film them, and they didn't know I was there filming them when it was happening. And that's when you hear this other voice go, Nerk! And so I thought it must have been me doing it, because I was already messing with them. You know, I was hiding in a corner, had the camera, and I was going to film their reaction to hearing this different voice. But the weird thing is, I don't remember doing that. And even weirder, it sounds nothing like me. Even when I try to mimic it, I don't sound like it.
Yeah.
So there's still something very odd about this. And yeah, even though I'm like, it has to be this explanation, I'm not satisfied by this explanation.
And it's in the movie. You can hear it real faintly. If you really listen for Nick, you can hear what is
going back and
ghost.
Watching tonight and doing that immediately.
Listen for the ghost.
This is incredible. This movie is haunted for real, everyone. We're starting I am starting a rumor. And it is a good marketing campaign.
we can take it further. Well, we think we know the ghost's name also, because shortly after this, Rachel, well, all through production, Rachel was having nightmares. And one night she...
Jesus Christ!
One night Rachel, and the basic script of Rachel's nightmares from my perspective, is Rachel starts having a nightmare, breathing heavily, maybe vocalizing in some way. I wake up, I check to see if she's okay, and then eventually I wake her up gently from her nightmare. That's usually the way that these nightmares go. But this night, Rachel starts going, "Hugh, Hugh, Hugh." And I was like, I think our ghost is named Hugh. And so we just started referring to him as Hugh.
Yeah.
And when That's weird amazing. Things would happen, we would say, I guess Hugh's here again or something. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Wow.
Yeah. The nightmares were also like, there's a scene in the movie where I'm just talking about how I'm having like nightmares, like increasingly terrifying nightmares. That's real. That's just us talking. I really was telling Nick, like, we were just, both of us felt terrible all day long, and I was just, like, telling him about my nightmares, and then he's like, stop! Comes back in with a camera, and I didn't even, I kind of knew when he started entering the room, like, he's gonna be filming me, but, yeah, so that's just me genuinely vocalizing, we're all gonna die on Scary New Year, I know it's gonna happen, you know, we didn't, but it really did feel like to both of us, like something horrible was going to happen, and just had like a lot of anxiety. And weirdly, wow. Like when we shot that scene afterwards, or not, we didn't think of it as a scene, we're just filming our lives.
Yeah.
Even though Nick did that afterwards, we're like, well, we'll never use that. Like, and then during editing at one point, I was like, wait a second. Don't we have, I wonder if that footage is any good. And then was like, it's kind of creepy. So, yeah.
That's amazing.
Holy cow, that's so cool. But then also, can y'all share like the distribution model that you're doing? Because it's very interesting how you are distributing this movie. I put that in scare quotes for people
who aren't. Well, so, and this was actually something we decided way early on when we first came up with the idea for the movie. We decided we wanted to do this. We wanted to make it really, really intimate and really personal. And also we wanted to include I hesitate to use the term set piece given what it is, but it is a set. It's a micro budget set piece in the middle of the movie where there's a seance that happens in real time. Mm-hmm. And we knew that in order for this to work, people would have to be really locked into it. And mm-hmm. So we just decided from the beginning, you know, we're never going to release this online. We're only going to do live screenings of it. And that way there's always going to be, you can more or less guarantee that the audience is in that moment. They're not going to take their phone out and start scrolling, and they're not going to pause it or whatever, or get up and go do something else like while it's happening. You know, they'll actually be there. And that was basically the only way we could ensure that that moment gets a chance of working with people. And it really does seem to work with people. Not with everybody. It's definitely a divisive moment, but the people that it works for, and what I love about it is that it works for them in different ways and ways that are weird and idiosyncratic, personal for them. And people walk away from it with different feelings. Like some people walk away from it saying that was so scary in that scene. And we've had some people say, oh, I just liked how you could tell that you guys are all really close friends. because it's a really intimate moment too, and I was like, I love that. That's what you walked away from it with. But it's a moment that we thought only works in that intimate group setting of watching a movie publicly. So that was what we. So yeah, so we just decided we're never going to release it online. We will most likely never work with an official distributor of any sort, although I guess if somebody wanted to do a theaters-only distribution run of it, we would talk with that person. But thus far, nobody's been knocking down our door to do theater-only distribution for it. So we've just been booking our own screenings. We've been doing festivals. We also have been booking just sort of DIY spaces. We did one screening in a guy's driveway We're doing, we got a university screening coming up this spring. We're going down to Austin in 2 weeks. We're screening it at an improv theater down there. So basically anywhere we can get that people will screen it. If we can, well, I'd be open to letting them screen it even if we weren't present, but we're trying to be there for as many screenings as possible too, which again is because like the movie's very personal. It involves 20 years of home video, all this stuff. And so it's really meaningful for us to go and engage with people. Also, we try to sell books when we're there. So
yeah, because on top of this, you have Die Die Books, which I'm right.
So that's a perfect segue. But before we do segue completely into that, I am curious if people are interested in potentially doing a screening, how would they get in touch to do that?
Contact us, contact@diediebooks.com is the best way. Okay. But yeah, we're not that hard to track down if somebody wants to. In fact, that's the way our Chicago screening came about, was that a guy wanted to see us at the Queer Fear Festival and didn't get to see the screening. And he found our contact on our website and asked if we would ever be coming to Chicago. And I said, sure. And I said, hang on, let me figure out the logistics of it. But, you know, then 3 weeks later or something, we had a screening in Chicago booked. And all it takes is one person reaching out to us. And if we can make it happen, we'll make it happen. But we might have just gotten lucky that time. But yeah, we found a venue. They were willing to do it. Chicago's 7 hours away from us by car. So we drove up there. We had friends there. We stayed with them. So yeah, it was good.
Hell yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you did mention the Die Die book. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about this press?
It's kind of like the series, if you know, 33 and a third or Boss Fight books, where it's sort of every single book is by a different author on a different singular work of horror movie. Every book is by a different author on a different horror movie. Just one horror movie, not like a series or anything. And that the idea is just to get like a really good deep dive on it may be like the author's relationship to it. It may be sort of like research. We've had like the movie Threads, the author was like a nuclear researcher and a nuclear scholar nuclear scholar and activist, not a nuclear scientist of any kind. We've had other folks that just wrote on books that are like, or on movies that are really personal to them. Sleepaway Camp, we have BJ and Harmony Colangelo doing like the queer reading on that. Just like to get like a really good, like we're always trying to get authors to really like get a movie you're really obsessed with and then just like chase your obsessions down that like rabbit hole as far as you can go. Is sort of the idea that we want to encourage with every book.
They're really good. Biased, but whatever, it's fine. The most recent one on the Wolfman is so fucking heartbreaking, and shameless plug from my website, Dread Central, Chad Collins did an incredible review of that broke my heart. And if y'all want to really cry, read the Wolfman that just came out as part of the Die Die book series. It's incredible.
Yeah, Rachel and I are both really proud of that book, but because of the weird circumstances surrounding its publication, which I won't bury the lead for the listeners, the author killed himself shortly after delivering his manuscript. And it was still, it wasn't quite final yet, but he and I had discussed it and we had a path for revision, but then he died and then we had to kind of figure out how to get the book finished. And that involved adding an afterword that discussed those circumstances. And it was all very emotional and difficult. But then now that the book is out, it's been hard trying to get people to review it because you usually have the author usually helps with stuff like that also. And also there would be, you know, people I've reached out to who I know knew Philip and would have been happy to support the book. It's very emotional for them, so it's harder, it's trickier in that regard too. So I was really grateful that Chad wrote such a thoughtful, it almost wasn't even a review, it almost was more like a personal essay it ended up being. And so I was really happy with that, because even though the book is great, we've had a hard time getting press for it because the people who would be inclined to write about it are people who are close with the author, and they then feel weird about it. So, so that ended up being really, really helpful for us. So,
well, yeah, everyone listening, it's a really fascinating look at the Wolfman and also, but like specifically Lon Chaney Jr.'s relationship to the character. And it's a very harrowing look at kind of at like his relationship to his father. And so if you're interested in that, a different kind of look at the Wolfman, I think we'll put the link in the description of the podcast so y'all can check it out. But yeah,
it's also a funny book too. Philip was a very funny writer, and so you know, it's not all dour. Like there's this part in it where he just has almost a chapter long just like Mystery Science Theater-esque takedown of this terrible movie called Man-Made Monster that Lon Chaney Jr. and the director of The Wolfman, George Wagner, did before The Wolfman. And the movie is dog shit, and Philip just spends probably 5,000 words just taking down this movie, like scene by scene. And it's great, you know, it's also a very funny book, so.
Well, and I mean, it's such a cool idea. If you guys have seen success so far with this model of doing one movie per book, has that been going since you're relatively new press for them, like relatively speaking?
It depends on one's definition of success.
But, you're continuing to do what you're doing?
Yeah. Gosh. We're not making money hand over fist, but we are proud of the books that we've put out so far. We've got more books that are on in the pipeline. We already know what our next three book releases are going to be that haven't been announced yet. So we have no plans of stopping soon. And also by design, each book is supposed to be advertisement for the entire series because they, you know, they're designed to be collectible. Like we put a lot of care into the art direction of the series so that the books especially will be appealing to collectors who want the entire series on their bookshelf. And we do have people like that. And I think that each new book is going to get us more people like that. And we haven't really hit the tipping point yet where it's suddenly this like runaway success, but I think it's kind of designed to build a cult following, and I think we're on our way to that. So
hell yeah, that's so cool. But before we jump into your Scarred for Life picks, I am curious about how each of you got introduced to the horror genre. And Rachel, I'll start with you. Like, how did you get introduced to horror? Has it been a thing your whole life? Like, when does that enter your life story?
I had such a interestingly ambivalent. I had such a weird relationship with horror when I was a kid. And it's very in line with my character's personality in our movie, where the way I can best describe it is when I was a kid, there was this scary ride at Six Flags in St. Louis. It was like you would go on a boat ride and scary stuff would be, there'd be like a witch and like other little like scary noises and like little animatronics coming out to spook you. And I would beg my parents to take me on it at Six Flags, like over and over, multiple times while we were there, every single time we went. And when I would get into the tunnel, I would just put my hands over my eyes and just scream the entire time. Like, didn't see any of it, didn't hear hardly any of it. We would get out and I'd be like, I have to go again because I didn't see or hear anything. And my parents are like, that is your own stupid fault, you idiot. Like, we're not just gonna keep taking you. I don't think I actually ever, maybe once I finally did it, it may have actually broken the spell and I was like, oh, it's not that scary. scary. But the positive is gonna be so scary. So I was so scared of everything. I actually slept with the lights on until I was like 16 years old, maybe 18 years old. An embarrassingly long amount of time. I don't think it was like that I was scared of the dark by the time I was in high school, but
Rachel
was just like,
still sleeps with the lights on.
I have a nightlight.
Here's the tea.
So that's not all the
lights. Rachel stopped sleeping with the lights on because I insisted that we, I was like, I cannot sleep with this much light. Now, she didn't sleep with all the lights on. I think when she was a kid, she slept with literally every light on.
All the lights.
I did the same thing. I could put on.
Yeah. Just all of them. But yeah, I was scared of like everything. And there were some Halloweens where, but my dad really encouraged us to like, loves horror movies and was like showing us like Terminator and Alien when we were like 5 and 6, me and my brother. And on the other hand, my mom is just terrified of horror movies. And my dad would be like showing us this stuff. Then my mom would be like, me and Rachel, we don't like horror movies. So you're going to not be a scary thing for Halloween, right? And I'd be like, I guess not. But so I kind of like vacillated for quite some time as a child between being really into them. I watched a Tales from the Crypt episode once when I was a kid that I didn't watch anything else scary for like 3 years. That one scared me.
Which episode do you remember?
The one where the guy has he's a ventriloquist and he has a conjoined twin on his hand. That one, I don't know why. There's nothing. Honestly, it's not even a very good episode. But really upset me for some reason. So I had a really ambivalent relationship with it when I was a child, and then as an adult, came to like reached a sort of tipping point where I was like, okay, now this is my whole thing. Like, cool. No.
Was there a movie that like tipped you over into horror? Was there like an experience?
Oh, into just this is my thing now? No, it was an experience. I have bipolar disorder, and I had sort of like that. I was like undiagnosed for like a long time. When I was in grad school, this is the most millennial thing anyone will ever say. The first time I was in grad school. the first time I was in grad school, I had to drop out basically because I was having what I didn't realize then was like a mixed bipolar episode. And after that, the year after that, Nick and I just spent the entire year watching like 2 and 3 horror movies a day. It was just like comforting. I don't know why.
Fuck yeah.
Just the thing. Christian and I also, Christian from the movie, we also spent a good portion of my senior year in high school just watching a lot of, we would like fall asleep watching Nightmare on Elm Street a lot.
Aww.
I love that.
Yeah.
That was cute.
Yeah, we'd have sleepovers and we'd watch that, and we'd also watch The Land Before Time, which is not scary.
I love Range.
That movie is traumatizing, though.
It's very sad. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And then, Nick, what about you? How did you get introduced to the horror genre?
Yeah, I've been actually trying to remember and come up with some sort of narrative about it, but I am having a hard time. I didn't really watch horror as a kid, but I always liked the scary stuff in movies, which is, we'll get into that with Mickey's Christmas Carol, because that's kind of like a great example where, and I think that it may have been because I grew up incredibly religious in an evangelical Christian family. And so a lot of this stuff was verboten, you know, you just didn't engage with this sort of like devil-y adjacent stuff.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like, I was a boy in the Midwest and like you want things to, and also I wasn't really into sports, but like you still pretend like you're into sports or like you are into sports, but like you're not really, but you still wear your Cardinals hat and, you know, and so it's like, You also have your friends talking about, or, you know, Rachel talking about Terminator on the playground or whatever, and you want to be into that cool stuff too. And so you just kind of latch onto whatever little scrap of that you can get. And I think a lot of that was like the horror-y type stuff in other things, where you'd be like, oh, but you know what was the really cool part in Aladdin? Was when Jafar turned into the genie at the end, and he's like this best badass part. Devil demon, you know, and yeah. Like that's what you latch on to. And,
hell yeah.
You know, not the wussy stuff like the magic carpet rides, you know, that's for girls. But Jafar is a genie with his big rippling muscles at the end. That's for boys. That's cool boy stuff.
That's for the boys.
Hell yeah. That's my kind of cool boy stuff.
Yeah. And so I think that maybe that was sort of there. And and then along with Rachel, kind of the, well, in college, I started getting more into, I started getting into like more extreme horror stuff. Like I was really interested in I had seen a documentary that talked about Last House on the Left, and I really wanted to see Last House on the Left. I don't think it was until like maybe my junior year I tracked down a copy of it, and I was just like, yes, this movie's amazing. And, you know, I saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre the first time when I was in college. And so I just started kind of getting into more, like really diving into the deep end with just like the most extreme. So I was really into like I Spit on Your Grave, and these were like
you got the college edgelord boy face. It's important to experience that.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I ever outgrew the college edgelord boy phase, but so I might still be.
Mentally, like mentally, right. I bet you did at least.
Well, and that's the thing too is that I don't think I was ever mentally exactly like. I don't think the appeal, it was always like, I was always trying to find ways to write papers about it. Like, I remember being in a Chaucer class and wanting to write a paper that was about, like, I forget which story from the Canterbury Tales. I was like, this story has parallels with Last House on the Left. And I want to write a paper about how this story about somebody going into the woods and having bad things happen to them, how like this is a literary trope that continued in through to Last House on the Left. And so the seeds of Die Die books really were planted there, where it was just like, how can I both be an edgelord and pretentious?
Hell yeah. That's my favorite kind of, that's why I love academia. Yeah. Or pop academia, so I don't have to go back to grad school, because I already made that mistake. but before we jump into your pick, I am curious for both of you. Do you remember the last movie that really scared you?
Like most recently?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably Skinamarink. And we actually have a shorthand for it around here where it's like, we're like, what is the... like, what's the elevator pitch for Skinamarink? And it's like, what's the monster, whatever? And it's essentially like, I'm in a scary place and I feel bad is how I would describe, like, what's scary about that movie?
Perfect.
No, you're in a scary place and you feel bad. And so I just, now that I sleep with the lights off, mostly. I have nightmares all the time. Like I have very frequent nightmares, and I'll like wake up screaming when I have nightmares. I'm sure not pleasant to sleep in a room with me. I'll have these like, so it's upsetting. Oh, and I sleep when I wake up from dream. I have so much messed up. So when I'm falling asleep, I fall asleep really slowly. There's this thing called hypnagogic hallucinations where you're like half asleep and half awake and you're just sort of like hallucinating stuff. So I'll be like half asleep and think that there's just like I'll be like, la, 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 and Nick's like, what? And I'll be like, I thought I saw a squiggly thing above the bed.
Okay, I suffer from this too, because I have a lucid dream that happens all the time, depending on if I'm sleeping on my back or on my side. I have severe arachnophobia, and I will go to sleep and I will either see like a giant spider that like is on my nightstand that hides behind something, if I'm laying on my side, and I will wake up and I'll be like, where the fuck is the spider? I can't go back to bed. Or like, I'll be laying there and I will, if I'm on my back, I will literally see spiders coming down off the ceiling, like on webs over my bed, and I will freak the fuck out. So I know exactly what you're talking about. I never had a term for it before, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Read up on it, because I was so glad when I got a term for it, because I was just like, boy, I guess I'm crazier than I thought I was. I've never met a person who has the same thing. That's so great. Great.
Well, but now and Rachel it's always has like a,
falling asleep.
Rachel has a new term for it.
A new term for
it. A skinamarink.
I'm having a skinamarink.
I'm having a skinamarink.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
That's fucking terrifying, and that really does convey the hell that you are experiencing in your dreams, because I have a lot of nightmares too, and that is a very good way to describe it. So now I'm going to take your term and continue using it and saying I had a skinamarink last night.
Everyone should. It's such a good applicable term. You wake up in the middle of the night.
It really is. It completely describes it.
Yeah.
It completely describes it. Wow. And what about you, Nick? What was the last movie that you saw that absolutely terrified you? Was it the same movie?
No, unfortunately, I don't like getting asked this type of question, because I'm one of those dorks who's like, well, I don't really get scared watching movies, which being a horror movie person is like, you don't want to be that guy. But I am thinking about I'm thinking about filmmaking and stuff when I'm watching the movies, so I don't really get scared watching them. But I will say, I'll do a kind of like sideways plug here for when I was a kid, the things that would always really unsettle me were the ones that were about like hell or the devil. Like, I remember I almost recommended one for this episode we're doing now, which was this Yosemite Sam cartoon that I think is called Devil's Feud Cake. And it's just about Yosemite Sam dies while trying to get Bugs Bunny, and he ends up in hell. And then he's talking to the devil, and the devil's like, okay, you're all right, but what I really want is Bugs Bunny, so I'll let you go back to Earth, but you have to get Bugs Bunny. And he keeps dying and going back to hell and being given like one more chance to go get Bugs Bunny. When I was a kid and I saw this just on a Saturday morning, it just scared the piss out of me, you know? But it wasn't because it was scary, it's because it was like, when you die, you could go to hell. Like, you know, that was the thing that was so scary for me.
That's fucking real, though. When you are a kid, I mean, I was raised Catholic, not even remotely similar to you, but like, when you have that like fear of the devil looming over your head all the time, there is nothing scarier than being like, I'm gonna get possessed, I'm gonna go to hell, it's the worst thing that could ever happen. Like, it is no fucking joke.
Yeah, no, and I will still, as an adult, sometimes see things that will trigger that same, like, it's just like an echo of it, but I recognize like the anxiety of that same feeling of that. And what I was going to mention as a present day thing that I'm currently semi obsessed with is Rachel got me for Christmas a ginormous book and this Blu-ray box set of this filmmaking team called, they were called the Ormond Organization, and they were based in Nashville, and they did exploitation films, but then it was a husband and wife and their son, and they got in a plane crash at one point in the middle of their career, and they survived it, and they decided they had like a conversion moment, and they decided they were going to dedicate the rest of their career not to making, you know, sexy shoot 'em up type exploitation movies, but they were going to instead apply their exploitation filmmaking skills for the Lord. And they started teaming up with evangelical or Southern Baptist ministers and making Christian movies. And when Rachel and I were at the Abattoir Film Fest last fall, we saw one of these movies, which is they teamed up with this Southern Baptist preacher named Estes Perkle and made this movie called If Footmen Tire You, What Will Horses Do? And it's all about, like, this one's not about hell. The next one, The Burning Hell, is about hell. But I really love If Footmen Tire You, What Will Horses Do? Which is all about the communists, the communist invasion that's bound to come in America. It was made in, like, 1971. And it's just this Mississippi preacher going on about how within 2 years, the communist takeover of America is bound to happen unless if a Christian revival breaks out and everybody turns away from their sin. And the whole thing is just this, an hour of rapid fire scare tactics about what communists are going to do to Christians in America whenever they take over within 2 years. So,
wow.
Yeah. And then the next one is all about hell, the burning hell. And then they made one about heaven, and it was a complete flop because nobody wants to watch an exploitation movie that's not based on scaring you into turning from your sin. But yeah, so anyway, I'm currently obsessed with these Ormond movies, and it has no small part to do with that childhood, fear of hell. So
wow, holy shit. Okay, well, I'm gonna go on a deep dive later about this because that sounds cool as hell.
Whoa. Yeah, the giant book about them that got published last year, it's called The Exotic Ones, and it's a very good book, but it is incredibly impractical. It's made to look like an old family Bible. Like, it has a gilded edge, and it's huge. Wow, okay. I had to sit in bed to read it. Like, I couldn't read, you can't carry it anywhere. It's like literally, like, yeah, like, it's like a 10-pound book.
Oh my God.
It's completely impractical. Nobody should have it. Rachel got it for me for Christmas, which was a great gift. But huge pain in the ass to read.
Hell yeah. Sick. So on that note, Nick and Rachel, what piece of media have you brought with you today for us to discuss?
Mickey's Christmas Carol.
Mickey's Christmas Carol. Hell yeah. I guess y'all were really expecting that one. So in this 26-minute animated special, classic Disney animated characters play the roles in this retelling of the Charles Dickens masterpiece, starring Scrooge McDuck as Ebenezer Scrooge.
This brought me back to my childhood. So I have to know, what about this is your Scarred for Life pick? Whose pick is it? Is it both of yours? Give us your horror story. I want to hear everything about your reaction to this when you first saw it.
So I brought it up as an option, and it was a little bit dovetailing on Nick's mention of the Yosemite Sam Bugs Bunny cartoon. But I was like obsessed with this movie as a child. Obviously the moment that's so scary is when Ebenezer Scrooge is like, "Spirit, whose lonely grave is this?" And then he says, "Why, yours, Ebenezer, the richest man in the cemetery." And like Nick and I have been saying that around the house, like,
"Yours, Ebenezer, the richest man in the cemetery."
He's much better at it than I am, but it was like, it's so, yeah, Scrooge, it's on the one hand, like, just a delightful, charming, like, children's retelling. It's got so much heart, and it's like, weirdly, it really gives, like, there's a dignity to this that does not, it's not existent, buddy. Mickey Mouse, like, Goofy has such pathos. We were talking the other day. Goofy plays Jacob Marley, and Jacob you really Marley. Like feel for you're like, oh man, it's sad that like Goofy's in hell now, like, but like he's got to carry these chains around. He's still like kind of tripping over them, but you're like, no, I buy it. But yeah, Ebenezer Scrooge McDuck, visited by three spirits. The second one, okay, the transition between the second spirit and the third spirit, so Ghost of Christmas Present to Ghost of Christmas Future, is so fast. It's just like a blink and suddenly everything's dark and spooky.
No,
and
it's like... better than a blink. It's a puff of smoke is what happens. Right. He just gets... Scrooge is there outside of a window and then just this smoke billows around him and suddenly you're just in this like Ingmar Bergman nightmare world.
It's a great way to describe it.
Yeah, and he's been watching Tiny Tim through the window and he's like, I didn't know that my employee who I've been horribly undercharging or underpaying for years and years has an adorable disabled son who's like low-key starving to death. Like suddenly it's like, and now I'm looking at Tiny Tim's grave because he's gonna die. And then there's these weasels, these mean weasels just laughing and digging Ebenezer Scrooge's grave. And the ghost of Christmas Future has no face at first, which was so creepy, and just points him over to the grave. Ebenezer sees it. He says the amazing line, why yours, Ebenezer? And then pushes him into the grave and he's falling into hell and like grabbing on and like, I can change. You can see the like fires of hell coming up.
Fires of hell.
Yeah. And it goes on like for a while, like before he comes back into his like safe and sound in his bed on Christmas morning. And it just, it's a lot darker than you would expect from Mickey's Christmas Carol. I was so obsessed with it. I would rent, like the scary boat ride, I would rent it, I would make my parents rent it all the time, July, like, February. They'd be like, it's not Christmas. And I'd be like, well, you told me I could pick one, so this is my pick. And I'd watch it, and I'd get, like, close to the end, and I'd be like, here comes the scary part. Like, hooray, hooray. But I picked it, too, because I knew Nick, I propositioned Nick on it, because I knew it would resonate with him. From all of his fears of hell as a child.
Well, and also, Rachel knows this, but you all don't know this. I have a deep love for Christmas specials of all sorts, and similar to how Rachel would watch Mickey's Christmas Carol year-round as a kid, for me, as an adult, when I was in college, I remember I used to have to apologize to my roommate because I had gotten, like, they had just put, like, the Rankin-Bass Christmas specials out on DVD. And I was like, I'm sorry, I just need to warn you, I'm going to be watching these constantly. And so if you ever just come in the room, like, most college roommates, like, you worry about walking in on your roommate masturbating. But in our room, it was like, no, you might walk in on me watching, you know... like Rudolph and Frosty's Christmas in July and like March.
Oh my god.
Nestor the long-eared Christmas donkey, just at any point in time you might walk in and I'm in the middle of it. So yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. Amazing. I love that so much. So I had never seen this before. I had never seen this before. And I will say, I did think at first the weasels, because I looked away for a second, and I thought the weasels were grave robbing Tiny Tim's grave. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, this is, what the fuck with these weasels? And like, I was like, the weasels steal? And I was like, oh, wait, no. That's not what's happening. But I have seen plenty of Disney movies, as we've talked about on this podcast, go to dark places like that. So I was prepared, but that was not the case. But yes. I just had to share, not grave robbing.
I love that this was the pick because the joy of this podcast sometimes is revisiting things that I have not seen since I was a kid. And this short film was ubiquitous for my childhood. I don't know when I first saw it. I don't remember how I first saw it. My recollection is that we had a VHS tape of a bunch of shorter Disney things. I remember this. I remember the Sleepy Hollow one. I remember there's like a Halloween episode of like with like ghosts and stuff, and I have a recollection of like ducks moving around a cauldron, and I remember that, and I remember this, and I remember watching them almost back to back. So I don't know if like my, I was trying to Google this. I was like, was this like on a, because it was released on VHS, but it's only 30 minutes. I was like, was this released on like some collection? I really couldn't find anything on it. I don't know if my dad had just, you know, taped it off of television, and so I just had like this really long movie set of various, you know,
that
Disney
was my
shorts.
Situation was it was okay. A taped off of TV on a tape with like five other things. So,
and see, that's yeah. What I'm wondering if it's the same for me, because I literally was like, was this released in a package? I looked up the release history of it, and it had a VHS, and I do remember seeing the VHS tape that was just this movie or the short film, but I couldn't find anything else. So I'm guessing that my dad just had recorded either off of, you know, a couple different Disney things that we had rented over time or off of television. I'm not 100% sure, but I would remember sitting down and just, it would be short film, short film, short film, short film. And it would just be all of these kind of spooky ones. Cause I mean, this is, even though it's, you know, Christmas set, it is very spooky. And it like, as a kid that loves spookiness, and this was just constant repeat for me. I just remember watching it all the time, to the point that I have not seen this probably. I'm 43 now, and I can't have seen it for at least 35 years. Like, I'm thinking I was probably 6 or 7 maybe when I saw it. And I could anticipate what was happening before it happened. And it just brought back so many memories of watching this as a kid, like just little details, the coal where he's like, Mickey wants to heat up the ink, and he used one last week, and it's like a single coal that is left in this bucket. I remember that. Or Scrooge is like tapping the sign constantly because Marley is crossed off and his name keeps getting snow on it, so people can't see that it's Scrooge. Like the ego is the narcissism in that is so funny to me now as an adult, but as a kid, I just remember him hitting that sign and knocking all that snow down. It's so wild to me that I remembered every single thing about this short film that I have not thought of in probably 35 years.
Well, and that's the thing that's so amazing about it, is that it actually is a remarkable little work of cinema. Like, it's,
yeah,
it has, it's really, the colors in it are really great. And like, better than, there's this sort, just this sort of rich beauty to the whole piece that it's like, oh, somebody really cared. The music in it is really good. And, you know, I think all of those things, like, it has those little beats, like you're mentioning, Terry, that it's just those things that stick with you. And, you know, that's the sign that somebody actually gave a shit, as opposed to, you know, they weren't phoning it in on this.
Well, and
no, it
two...
looks expensive. Oops, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. Well, Nick and I also, in preparation for this, we listened to, they did like 10 years before this was released, they did an audio like recording and put out a little LP of like, it's got like songs in it, and it's way more levity, like that this version of it. Weirdly, the witch from Snow White plays the ghost of Christmas Future, which has its own like creepiness to it.
Yeah, it's basically the same. It's like, it's really interesting. You can find it on YouTube and listen to the whole thing if anybody's perverse enough to want to do that other than us. But yeah, like it was, I think, 1974, right? That, so like way before they would have been thinking, let's do the movie of this. Like, I think Disney was just putting out like albums that were like retellings of classic stories, but with Disney characters. And I think this was one of them in that series. And then they basically took, it's basically the exact same thing, but with like some cast swaps and more bad ideas. Like the movie version did just like stripped out everything that wasn't working or revised it to make it better. Like Rachel pointed out that the Goofy character, I'll let you talk about it because...
Oh my god. Okay. Goofy. So many things to say about Goofy in Mickey's Christmas Carol. Okay. Goofy. You know him as just like, oh, he's just the silliest of all the characters. You can't possibly, like, you empathize with Goofy, but he's ridiculous. Yeah. Like, come on. Like, he's just a silly guy and just the clown of the show. Goofy in this 1974 album that's just a bad rough draft of Mickey's Christmas Carol is just like, hey, Ebenezer, like, and he's like, why are you wearing these chains? And he's like, oh, they must just be in fashion this year. Like, the whole just constantly yucking it up, not with the solemnity of a person who's been in hell dragging chains around. But they somehow manage in Mickey's Christmas Carol to walk the line of like, Goofy is Goofy, but he is Goofy that has been worn down. Like, he has had a rough way
about it. Yes! Oh my God! I was so surprised. I was like, because when I started seeing that, like, all of the beloved Disney characters were having cameos as other characters, which I ranted about this to Terry before we were talking, and I was like, this is why I have the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because Disney just fucked around for so many years with these Disney characters and these animated characters and just put them in fucking everything, and now they think they can do that with anything, and it's not how it works. So that was just, like, my dumb little high horse I got on about, like, all of the hilarious cameos. But, where was I going with this?
Goofy. Goofy crushes it.
Yes, Goofy. And so, but like, so I saw Goofy, I'm like, oh, he's going to be just like his kind of dumb self. But I loved how they made him a worn down version of Goofy who very much understands the consequences of his fucked up actions. Even though he's still the slapstick. He is a very solemn Goofy, which was very shocking. I was a little bit scared by that. I was like,
yes!
I don't like solemn Goofy. This instills fear in my heart.
It's alarming because you're watching sad Goofy and you're thinking, but Goofy's supposed to be happy. And you're just like, oh, this is what hell will do to you, kid. Like, boy.
It's
really like, something.
Oh my God.
I think that this is like why this works so well as like something that is terrifying, because these are all characters that, I mean, I grew up on Mickey, you know, grew up on him, yeah. Goofy. Grew up on him. When I was watching this, I probably was about the same time as when DuckTales started. So I had like DuckTales with Scrooge McDuck. Like, these are all characters that, and my dad, one thing I remember is my dad had this collected book of Scrooge McDuck cartoons. Like, it was just this big, like almost coffee table like book that had all these comics, and I would read them. I love Scrooge McDuck. I loved all these characters. And to see them put through so much trauma in 30 minutes is quite upsetting. Goofy's the idea of, like, as you guys have been talking, the fact that he is this lovable kind of scamp. Gorsh! You know, he's always tripping over things. He's always, like, his limbs are so long. He just is ungainly. And here he is dragging these chains that he says, you know, that he's doomed to carry him through eternity. And then he has like a little bit of a joke to it, maybe even longer, but even that is tinged with something that is even more horrifying, a cosmic of time that goes past eternity. What? And so you see that, or you see Mickey, who's like crying at the grave of his son. Like, it's like, it's these characters that you have such childhood attachment to are going through pain, and it's upsetting.
Yeah, it's so upsetting. And well, and the other thing that's crazy about it that I was thinking about watching, like rewatching it before we did this podcast, is that, like, okay, so this is a children's movie where you're Scrooge McDuck as Ebenezer Scrooge is just a terrible person, just like, you know, bordering on sociopathic by the end of, you know, his life, his terrible life that he's ruined. And then spent ruining everyone else's life. Like, you're empathizing. Like, that's the character you're rooted to. Like, that's so weird for a children's movie to be like, but it's like, it functions. Like, they can get away with it because he's still a Disney character. But you're so rarely, like, Ebenezer Scrooge is so much worse than Scrooge McDuck and also so similar. And you're just empathizing with him the whole time. And by the end of the movie, you're like, oh, no, I was empathizing with this character who's going to hell. Like, it could be me.
The other thing that's strange about that I actually just realized is that usually when you're connected, like Scrooge isn't an anti-hero. Usually when you're connected to somebody who's a bad person, you're having a vicarious thrill of like, oh, well, what if I was a mobster, or, you know, whatever it is, like, you know, like
if I was making blue meth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you're kind of like getting off on that vicarious thrill of like, oh, well, he's a bad person, but what a badass life that person has or whatever. There's none of that in the story of Scrooge. Like, you're never supposed to be like, oh, wow, it must be great to rob from the widows and swindle the poor. You know, that's not the enjoyment.
On the same day.
Yeah.
I love this jump because it's short and it's for kids, but I love the jump of him dancing with his love and then jumping right to him like reclaiming the honeymoon cottage that she's talking to him about, like immediately yeah. jumps to him just being an absolute asshole. And I know that it's obviously more complicated, but just love a good complete 180 in attitude.
Yeah. It's all great.
I realized I did not watch as much Disney as I thought I did as a kid. I watched like the Disney princesses, but I think I'm remembering that I think I found like Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse and all of them to be kind of irritating as a child.
It might be a slight generational difference because
I definitely think it is. I think I got a very different kind of Disney.
Well, if you didn't have random VHS tapes with just whatever happened to be on the Wonderful World of Disney for like that year, you didn't get that same just sort of like random like, oh, here's short films from 1956 coupled with like short films from the 80s and stuff that just happened to all be on TV.
So what we had, my stepdad was a big Looney Tunes person, so I had that for all of the Looney Tunes and also Ren and Stimpy. That's a hilarious thing I should not have been watching as a 5-year-old. But yeah, I did that with Looney Tunes. My stepdad was super into Looney Tunes, so I watched that a lot more as a kid than like older Disney stuff, but which is why I don't think I hadn't seen this. But I did love a Goofy movie, I will say. Just to, on the record, a Goofy movie is
Nick. I was spinning conspiracy theories last night about how I wonder if I suspect that Disney's or the Mickey's Christmas Carol with that was like a testing ground where they said, oh, you can get into some genuine pathos with Goofy. Maybe we should consider doing more stuff with Goofy, which may then, I don't know if this is true, but I could see that as having like then this. Led to yeah. Goof Troop and then that led to, because I'm also huge fan of a Goofy movie. Huge fan.
It's great.
I'm with you.
I also think that I loved a Goofy movie, and I think what really pissed me off was how everyone treated Goofy, because I thought that Goofy was a good dude. And I got really mad that everyone kind of treated him like an idiot because he had a good heart. I felt bad for Goofy as a child.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the things that I could go on about a Goofy movie, but one of the things that really I love about it is that, you know, like we were talking before, Goofy is just, he is Goofy. Like, that just is what his character is that he is Goofy. And so there's nothing wrong with Goofy being who he is. In fact, he seems very comfortable within his own skin. But when you're a teenage boy and Goofy's your dad, then suddenly all the things that make him Goofy, like all teenagers don't like that their parents are Goofy. So it's so perfect. Like, it's just a perfect teenage movie of just like, oh, yeah, your parents are Goofy and it's embarrassing. Like, his dad is literally Goofy. It's just great. It's perfect. I love it.
But speaking of Goofy, one of my favorite moments in this, watching this as an adult, is the stair moment when Scrooge is going up the stairs and Goofy is a ghost on the wall. Because so I was drawing in my head a direct parallel from this to Bram Stoker's Dracula to Dracula Den Loving It. Because it's very similar, particularly with Dracula Den Loving It, with the hilariousness of the shadow being an idiot. Feels very much like Goofy, but I will die on this hill that there is a direct correlation between what Francis Ford Coppola saw and this movie.
Everything starts with a Mickey's Christmas Carol from 1983. A Goofy movie, Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. It all starts here. I
so
like
influential.
It.
I have to say, though, that I've not rewatched this entire movie, but I did rewatch the Hell portion of it, but because I wanted to see if... if it was how close it was to Mickey's Christmas Carol, but there's a movie from the 70s, another Christmas Carol adaptation that's called Scrooge, and it definitely influenced Mickey's Christmas Carol for the climactic you're going into hell moment. But in the movie Scrooge, it actually follows Scrooge into hell, and there's this whole sequence in hell, and it's like, it's really brightly colored. Like, it's like psychedelically colored red. And Jacob Marley is like really spiteful against Scrooge. And he says, oh, well, you know, you're going to have an even bigger chain than my chain. And then he's like, bring in the chain boys. And then it's like this line of like leather daddies, like like muscular men with no shirts on, but like leather masks and leather pants, carrying this giant chain, come walking in, and they bundle Scrooge up. So it suddenly turns into this like sort of BDSM fantasy thing. Like, it's very bizarre, but
oh my god, I'm looking at there's a picture on IMDb. I'm gonna put it in chat. There's a picture on IMDb of this.
Is the Albert Finney Scrooge?
Yes.
This is amazing. This is absolutely amazing.
Sign
me up.
I wouldn't be surprised if there was some shadow play on a staircase in this movie, because this movie was definitely an influence on Mickey's Christmas Carol. I just don't know whether there is. So before we go saying Mickey's Christmas Carol did it first, you should at least check this one out.
Oh my god, this is so funny.
I am.
Yeah, just watch on YouTube the hell part, if nothing else, because it's really the lead up into hell is very, very similar too. It's like the death looking Ghost of Christmas Future who's not talking, and he's sort of scared.
I think I've actually seen
down
this.
Into it. Yeah. Yeah, I saw it in middle school, I think, but I haven't seen it since then.
Very formative.
I'm looking at some of the screenshots, and these images are, there's like one of, I think it's one of the ghosts, and he has like a wreath on his head and a beard. Like, this is bringing back a lot of memories of childhood, so I probably have actually seen this movie. Wild.
It's supposed to be
wild.
Pretty good.
I mean, it has muscle daddies with chains. I'm in.
Like, why not?
Sign me up. Wow.
And Scrooge is given the only cold room in hell. Make his office, his room in hell is a replica of his office, but it's super cold because he would never give Bob Cratchit that coal. So,
see, this sounds like heaven to me. We have leather daddies with chains. We have a very cold room because I am always very warm, so I want it to be iceberg cold. Like, this does not sound horrible to me.
Yeah, well, you're getting Charles Dickens put a message in there, and it's up to you to interpret whether it's a good message or a bad message. So, yeah.
Wow.
Hell yeah. Well, do we want to wrap up and give this our rating out of 5?
That sounds good to me.
Hell
wow.
Yeah. Well, now that I know, Terry, that your version of hell is, like, your version of heaven is Ebenezer Scrooge's version of hell / Charles Dickinson's version of hell. So that's incredible. Love that. And so on that note, Terry, how many weird Disney cameos out of 5 do you give Mickey's Christmas Carol?
All of them. This is a fantastic, this is a 5 out of 5. Fizzywig and Weasels and Ratty and Molly. Like, this is perfect. This is my childhood to a T. And it just brought back so many different moments that, like, I was sitting here going, okay, the giant, he's going to open up this roof and a woman is going to scream. Okay, he's going to jump down on the ground, and when he opens up the curtain, it's going to be this giant eye looking. Like, I knew it just back to back to back. And it brought me back. It brought me so much nostalgic joy watching this. But as an adult, it's very effective for what it's doing. In 30 minutes, it gives us a complete story. It gives us a trajectory. It gives us some horrific moments. And it takes out all the parts that are kind of unnecessary. Like, we understand the jump between Scrooge at the dancing with his girlfriend or love interest to ejecting her from her home. Like, we get that without needing to have other scenes. And it's very economical in the way it's telling the story, but it works. And so this is a 5 Disney cameos out of 5 for me. What about you, Mary Beth?
So I'm going to give it a 4. I don't have the same nostalgia factor, I think, as everyone else does. And I also think A Christmas Carol is boring. But
That's why it's good at 30 minutes.
That's exactly. I was going to say, it cuts out all the, trims all the fat. It definitely operates on one. We know this is for children and we have a short time span, but also very smart in how it takes like the essence of what makes it so, such a scary story, even for kids, and makes it pretty, a very effective look at A Christmas Carol. And again, the goofy part is my favorite. I think they did such a good job with that. And that alone is why this is such a good, for me, so good. But then Rachel and Nick, you have the final word. How many weird Disney cameos out of 5 do you give Mickey's Christmas Carol?
5 for me. Of hell yeah. All time. Yeah. All timer.
I'm tempted to give it a 4.5 because watching it this time, I did find myself thinking, while I appreciate the brevity, you know, the conciseness of the storytelling, I was like, it is a bit, you know, there are some places where maybe the story could be spread out a little more, get a little more detail in there. But since the scale on which we're rating is Disney cameos, I have to give it a 5 because I'm also including the fact that on the 1974 LP, some of the characters are different. The Jiminy Cricket doesn't play the Ghost of Christmas Past on the LP. Okay. It's Merlin from Sword in the Stone plays the Ghost of Christmas Past.
Huh.
And the Ghost of Christmas Future isn't played by Pete. I don't know what his character is named other than Pete. That's who he is in a Goofy movie. But it's not played by Pete. It's played by the witch from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Interesting.
And, yeah. And every time Scrooge asks a question, she goes, and that's it. So instead of being silent, you just hear this witch cackle. So there's even more cameos. If you go with both versions, there's even more obscure or more multifaceted Disney character cameos on it.
Wild. Yeah. Well, thank you both so much for joining us and allowing me to revisit this childhood obsession I had. So where can the listeners find you? Are you on social media? And the floor is yours to plug away with what you guys are able to talk about.
We're not on social media. We're not on social media at all. I'm so sorry. It's not. You'll never stream our movie online and you can't find us on social media. So good luck tracking us down.
You can find us at diediebooks.com. And we also have a mailing list that you can sign up for, and you should sign up for it. And you should buy a copy of Poltergeist by Jacob Trussell, Threads by Bob Mielke, The Wolfman by Philip J. Reed, and upcoming Sleepaway Camp and The Love Witch books. And keep an eye out for our next at least 3 releases that we'll be announcing hopefully by well before the end of the year. And you can also join our mailing list here about upcoming screenings of It Doesn't Get Any Better Than This. And you can get updates on our new horror feature Homebody that we are shooting this summer and all kinds of other good stuff. Actually, that's pretty much all the good stuff. We're not going to bog you down with just nonsense.
Hell yeah. Well, listeners, you've heard from us. We want to hear from you. What was your experience with Mickey's Christmas Carol? You can send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us directly on Twitter or social media, not just Twitter. I'm at MBMcAndrews on Twitter, and I'm at MB.McAndrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gaily Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast on social media. We are at Scarred Podcast on Twitter and Blue Sky, and at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, we do have a Patreon.
Thank you to iCar for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there, but most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.